Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 15, Current Enforcement Priorities, Insider Trading and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, Ethics Panel. David Miller, Ivan Harris, and Andrew Sutherland will discuss insider trading as well as the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and current enforcement priorities in connection with these two areas. Now, on to the podcast.
We're going to start off talking about insider trading. Some of you might be saying, well, why are we going to be talking about the FCPA? Well, as many of you know, the FCPA is a robust and critical area of enforcement, and actually, as of very recently, has been applied in the hedge fund space. So you'll hear us talk a bit after we finish insider trading about the FCPA. There are a lot of slides to our presentation in the book. Much of it is for reference purposes, because there's no way we could even get through that in an hour, but it will inform the discussion as we go through and will highlight what's important. So let's start off now with insider trading. Just as an overview, we're going to start off giving you the lay of the land, insider trading law, just as a real general high-level background stuff to inform, frankly, where things are right now and what the enforcement priorities are and, frankly, how to avoid investigations and what the best practices are. And as you note here in number two, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Salmon v. U.S., which is the first time the Supreme Court has weighed in on insider trading for nearly 20 years. And the most important thing you'll probably take away from today is that, believe it or not, with a little exception with respect to tender offers, there is no statute that defines what is prescribed in the insider trading world. It's judge-made, court-made law, which has led to a lot of ambiguity and a lot of challenges, particularly as of late. And we'll talk about cases called Newman. No, that's not from Seinfeld. Newman is a Second Circuit Court of Appeals decision, which was very important. And then, like it notes on the overview, we'll talk about the Supreme Court's decision in Salmon. So to give you an overview on the lay of the land, turning it over to Andrew.
Sure, I'll set this up in terms of going through the elements and what the government needs to prove to make an insider trading case. I also forecast in advance. I'm going to go a little bit off script that you won't find some of what I'm going to talk about in your books. We're going to talk a little bit about today the world of political intelligence and the government's recent efforts, well, maybe not so recent since they've been at it for a little while now, to policing information gathering in the political intelligence space. So we will talk a little bit about that. It's not in your materials. But given the recent activity in that area, including a case last week or the week before involving some government agencies, a consultant, and some portfolio managers, I thought we would spend a little bit of time talking about that. It's sort of a newer area to insider trading. It doesn't fit neatly into what we know insider trading to be, and it brings with it some real interesting analyses and discussion points as to what the actual violations are, how to avoid sort of running afoul of insider trading issues when gathering information in the political space. But anyway, let me start with insider trading. Two theories of liability under insider trading. The first is called the classical theory. Generally, the classical theory bars insiders from trading or tipping, and David will talk about tipping, based on material non-public information in breach of a duty of trust and confidence to either to the company itself and to the company's shareholders. David mentions there's no statute specifically prohibiting insider trading, but rather the anti-fraud provisions of the SEC bar the use of deceptive devices, schemes, or other artifices to defraud. And of course, there needs to be a nexus with buying or selling securities. So what are the elements? First, you need an insider, classical theory. Who are insiders? Well, officers, directors, employees, family could also be considered a corporate insider. Also would include a temporary insider. Those are individuals like lawyers, accountants, bankers who may be working with a company on a particular deal or have access to the company's material non-public information. Again, the key is material non-public information. So materiality, this is difficult. It's an objective test and it's often viewed by the government in hindsight with the benefit of perfect 20/20 vision. But over time, there's been several tests that evolved in connection with what is material information. One is what's called the reasonable investor test, and the other is the total mix tests. And depending on the kind of situation, these tests are a little fluid. But generally, the reasonable investor test is there a substantial likelihood that a reasonable investor will consider the information important to making an investment decision? You know, that's what's important to one investor may not be important to another, so it's really an objective test. The second test is the total mix test, total mix of information. Would the disclosure of the information or would the information itself alter the total mix of information available already out there in the public realm in making an investment decision? I like to look at it as, would that little bit of extra information, would that little bit of information cause you to move one way or the other in an investment decision? Does it change what's already out there meaningfully? And that's tricky too, particularly if you're building a mosaic of information, if you're an analyst, piecing together, ferreting out information, piling it together to come up with your investment thesis or an investment decision. Whether that piece of information is material is an important component, because portfolio managers, analysts, traders, they can have all the material information they want as long as it's public, and all the non-public information they want as long as it's not material. But what you can't have in your mosaic is material and non-public information. So what is some easier guidelines with respect to material information? Well, earnings. Having access to earnings information in advance of announcement is material. Ratings changes are important. Buy-sell recommendations, likewise. M&A activity, this merger may happen, this merger may not happen. Management control changes, auditor changes, events involving company securities. There's a little bit of a laundry list that's been developed over time in cases. But again, it's really, does the information provided change the mix of information you're looking at, or would a reasonable investor consider that information to be important? Non-public, again, material non-public. So what's non-public? Well, non-public information generally is information that's not been disseminated to the public. This would include information that has been released but might not have yet been digested in the public sphere, information that's passed out to some people but not others. Again, sometimes a tricky determination, but generally information that's been made available and is either accessible to the public. So, you know, good analyst knows where to go to get information and can ferret out information. But generally, information that's available or accessible to the public would not be considered non-public. Scanner, have to do it with knowledge that you're trading or tipping on material non-public information. So it's not strict liability. The government must prove that there was an intent component to the activity.
If I may, just one quick thing. Probably the most important question to always ask in assessing whether or not there is insider trading is not just whether or not there is material non-public information, because quite candidly, even if you have information that's material non-public information, you could trade on it. So long as you don't have a duty to either abstain from trading or to disclose the fact that you have MNPI when you do trade. So the key question in this analysis, whether it's classical theory or now the misappropriation theory, as Andrew's going to mention here, is do you owe a duty to someone? And this stretches into tipping liability, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Right. So I mentioned the duty component in the classical sense, the duty owed to the corporation or to its shareholders. That's the duty there. Changes a little bit, as David was alluding to, in the misappropriation theory. So second theory, misappropriation. So this goes beyond your traditional insider. It doesn't have to be a corporate insider, but bars any person with a duty of confidentiality from misappropriating confidential information to trade securities. So the way I look at this is, do you have information or are you trading on information that you're not supposed to have or was given to you from somebody who wasn't supposed to share that information? That's sort of a plain English way of explaining what the misappropriation theory contemplates. The elements, material information, is the same as the classical theory. Important to investors, altering the total mix of information. Non-public, also same, is the information readily available or not. Duty of trust and confidence. This is where we differ, where the classical and the misappropriation theory differs. Here, it's the duty owed to the source of the information, not to trade based on the non-public information. So how does that happen? Well, For example, government employee may have a duty to safeguard particular information with respect to what he or she is doing in the government. For example, you work at the FDA, you're working on drug approvals, you have information about pending approvals under the FDA guidelines. That information is embargoed until the FDA makes it public. If you're the FDA chemist looking at the approvals and you decide to trade on that information for personal gain, that's misappropriation. You're trading on information that's supposed to be kept confidential. Same as if you pass that information out to your friend and he or she trades on that information. The friend could be misappropriating the information if he or she knows that that information that he or she has, they're either not supposed to have, or they understand that the person giving them that information was not supposed to give that information out in advance of an announcement. That's misappropriation. Examples of duties: investment bankers could have a duty to a company that it's, he or she is working with. Lawyers have duties with respect to their clients. The list here: journalists, psychiatrists, mailroom employees, broker-dealers, et cetera, could have a duty to keep information confidential. The SEC did step in a little bit and enacted a rule, SEC Rule 10b-5-2, which also discusses the kinds of things that could give rise to a duty of confidentiality. So, for example, when the recipient of the information agrees to keep information confidential. So I'm going to give you information if you agree to keep it confidential. Person receiving the information says, yes, I'll keep it confidential, and then tips or trades on that information, that could be found to have breached the duty of confidentiality. Family members who have a history of sharing information in confidence, courts have found that that gives rise to a duty to keep information confidential. Husband and wife, same deal. Or friends who have a history or practice, and we see this in cases, a lot of sharing information back and forth, understanding that the friend will keep the information confidential. So those kinds of things could give rise to either the person conveying the information or the recipient of the information having to keep the information confidential.
Some of this gets a little bit complex, but to sort of think about in your mind, to conceptualize the difference between the two theories, which are the two real main pillars of liability. Think about it from the common perspective on the classical side, where you have somebody in a public company in the finance department or in the IR department who has now leaked that information to somebody else on the outside, usually in exchange for money, or maybe it's a family member. The person that was in finance or IR is the insider. So that's the classical theory and tipping under the classical theory. But then on the misappropriation side, I'm giving you some real world examples from my past in prosecution of those kinds of cases. You had, let's say, for example, you have somebody who has let their broker-dealer know something. The person's at a private equity firm that's going to do a deal. They need to move some money over as part of that deal. They tell their broker, thinking that it's being done in confidence, to explain why they need X number of dollars and where they need it to go. The broker takes that information, misappropriates, steals that information to trade on it, and then tips it, tipping down on the misappropriation side, down to other people. So that broker is not an insider or anything like that, but the broker has a duty of confidence and confidentiality to his or her client and to the brokerage firm, actually, to safeguard client information. So that's why misappropriation can sweep quite broadly, even well beyond the classical theory.
One thing with the misappropriation theory is that you don't actually have to, the government doesn't have to prove that you actually traded based entirely on that information. There's a discussion out there that it's sufficient if you just have the information and the information was a factor in a buy-to-sell decision. And again, scienter, you can switch a slide, David, is required as well. Again, you need to have some level of intent as to what you're doing. Tender offers, quickly, this is by statute. Section 14E of the Exchange Act prohibits insider trading in connection with tender offers. Prohibition kicks in if the person possesses material non-public information, knows or has reason to know that the information directly or indirectly was obtained from the offeror, the issuer, or their agent. The person buys or sells securities in connection with the tender offer. What's important here is there's no requirement that there be a breach of duty of trust and confidence. So if you have the information and you should know that it's coming from the offeror, issuer, or the agent, then that's sufficient. If you trade on that information, you could trip over Section 14E governing tender offers.
So now dealing with tipping liability, because this is really where the rubber meets the road, and frankly, where you know the issues come up, presumably, in your client's context, in your context, think about, again, these two pillars of liability, classical misappropriation and people tipping down. That's tipping liability. Well, how is it that people down the chain could potentially be liable, responsible, either both criminally or and or civilly? So first, you look at what are the liability on the tipper side here, okay? The person tipping the information breaches a duty, the most critical part of this whole thing, as we've talked about. And the tipper receives what's called a personal benefit for the tip. They get something in exchange. And we'll talk about what that something is, because that's a litigated point. As you can see under the bullets here, personal benefit by the Newman case was held to be something objective, consequential, something that's of potential gain of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature. But the Supreme Court had something to say about that in the Salmon case, which we'll talk about in a second. On the tippee side of the equation, so the person next down the chain, what Newman was important about is defining when somebody, a tippee down the chain, is responsible. What they have to know in order for them to be breaking the law in trading on material non-public information. Because originally, there was a strong movement, at least with respect to the government, that the tippee just had to know that the original insider or the original person who misappropriated the information did so in breach of a duty. Well, that's certainly true, but what was litigated in the Newman case was whether or not the tippee had to also know that that insider, that misappropriator, at sort of patient zero, if you will, received a personal benefit. And then, as we'll talk about, the Newman case went even further in redefining what that personal benefit is. And look, real quick, the penalties are significant. Criminal penalties, which include imprisonment under the security statute, up to 20 years imprisonment, hefty fines. And on the civil side of the equation, if the SEC is prosecuting a civil enforcement action, there are significant penalties and disbarment and employer fines, et cetera. And notably, just because you finally pay those penalties doesn't mean you're off the hook, because there could be post-violation oversight.
Well, one thing I will add on penalties is that the downstream tippies are liable for, so if you have a series of downstream tippies, the last trader is liable to the extent that the upstream tippers are also liable. So the liability flows downward. So if you're the last person in the chain, you can have some hefty liability. So we'll use Newman to set up the Supreme Court decision in Salmon. As David mentioned, these are two really important, I guess now, semi-recent cases, because they changed the way the government had to look at insider trading and what it had to prove to make a case, and then changed it back, so to speak. So they did a sort of a reset. Newman changed it a little bit, and then Salmon reset the state of play prior to Newman. Newman is a really interesting case because of the nature of the tipping downstream. The scheme in Newman, you had corporate insiders who were tipping out material non-public information about earnings, we talked about earnings earlier, to portfolio managers at two asset management firms, Level Global and Diamondback. And the portfolio managers, Newman and Kiazon, were convicted after a six-week jury trial for trading based on the material non-public information. The scenario was set up in two long tipping chains. So the material non-public information related to Dell and NVIDIA, the Dell shipping chain had a corporate insider, part of the investment relations group there, who tipped to an analyst, who then tipped to another analyst, who then tipped to Newman, and then yet another analyst received the same information and tipped to Kiazon. So you have insider, tippy trader. Insider, tippy trader. So you're the downstream tippy, the trader. What is your responsibility here? Where is your liability? How does insider trading apply to you? Well, the government ran into problems because they didn't offer any affirmative evidence that Newman or Kazan, again, the downstream folks, were aware of the source of the tips or any benefit received by the people that were tipping or the original tippers. And so they appealed. After their convictions, they appealed. And they argued that the jury instruction was faulty because it failed to apprise the jury that a tippee must know that the tipper received a personal benefit in exchange for the tip. They argued that the government's evidence was legally insufficient to establish that the tipper received a personal benefit for the tip and the tippee knew of this benefit. We'll talk about the personal benefit prong or element in a little bit. But the key principles for tipper liability, for the tipper now, requires a breach of fiduciary duty by the tipper. And to breach that duty, the tipper must do two things. One, disclose MNPI, which we talked about, and receive a personal benefit, directly or indirectly, in exchange for the tip. That personal benefit prong, in my view, David may disagree with this point, has been short shrifted by the government in proving insider trading cases for a long time. It got to the point where they simply had to demonstrate that a person or a tipper was friends or knew or was an acquaintance with someone else or to the person that he or she passed the information along to. And the Second Circuit, for at least briefly, reversed that. Also for tippee liability is a derivative of the tipper's liability, but a tippee is only liable when the insider breached the duty. You have to have the antecedent breach, and the tippee knew or should know that there was a breach, and that breach, again, broken out, is that the tipper disclosed material non-public information for a benefit. That's the breach of the duty. You have to have a benefit.
And that's what makes it illegal, right? Because if you're, and this was the seminal case called Dirks, if somebody's tipping somebody else because they're a whistleblower, or they're, for whatever reason, they're trying to get out information that they think is against the law that's happening at their company, they're not doing it for any kind of compensation or remuneration. There's no personal benefit. They're doing it because they're trying to be a good citizen. And if there's no breach at the beginning, there's no breach of fiduciary, meaning there's no personal benefit that's received, then everybody down the line is not guilty.
Again, in terms of how these cases are proven, often you hear from the government, well, the analyst or the trader is a sophisticated person. He or she surely must know that this information was tipped in breach of a duty for a personal benefit. They're sophisticated. They should know or they consciously avoided not knowing. The Newman case rejected that presumption and said that to prove the personal benefit, the government must show that there was a meaningfully close personal relationship that generated an exchange. So a close relationship between the tipper and the tippee that generated an exchange that is objective, okay, something consequential that mattered and represents at least a potential gain of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature. So really set forth a higher standard of proof for the government to make that case. And again, my point was a second or two ago that historically, or at least up until the Newman case, that prong was getting watered down and the government was just alleging that the two people were friends and that was sufficient. The Second Circuit disagreed. So the test then, before we kick it over to Salmon, is that to sustain an insider trading conviction against a tippee, the government must prove each of the following elements. That's the corporate insider was entrusted with a fiduciary duty, okay? The information to a tippee, breached his fiduciary duty by disclosing confidential information to a tippee in exchange for a personal benefit, one that matters, okay? And the tippee knew of the tipper's breach, again, that the information was material non-public and divulged for a personal benefit. And the tippee nevertheless used that information to trade in the security or tip someone else. That's the test that Newman articulated and sent the government into a little bit of a panic in terms of how it was going to make its insider trading case.
So we'll do this fast because we still have to talk about the FCPA, but the Salmon case became pivotal because of the fact that after this test that was just pronounced sort of changed the way the government had to address insider trading enforcement actions, and particularly when it came to not only the knowledge of personal benefit, but also what a personal benefit is, and some would say heightening the standard. And then the Supreme Court did not hear the Newman appeal, the government was rightfully so concerned about their efforts, and they made a lot of pronouncements to that effect. Enter now the Salmon case. Newman, Second Circuit. Salmon was in the Ninth Circuit in California. And this was an insider trading case that the facts are here, but essentially, in short, you had a defendant who had a brother-in-law whose brother was at a major bank, and basically the brother would tip the defendant's brother-in-law, and the brother-in-law would tip the defendant on information. He was convicted at trial for insider trading and appealed to the Ninth Circuit. And Judge Rakoff, who is a judge here in the Southern District of New York, was actually sitting by what's called designation. He was invited to sit on the Ninth Circuit to hear cases, and coincidentally, he got this one, and wrote an opinion basically upholding the conviction and rejecting the defendant's argument that under Newman, because insider brother didn't get some money back from the defendant's brother-in-law, the two brothers didn't pay each other, that there wasn't a personal benefit under Newman. Ninth Circuit said, no. That's not what Newman was saying, especially not in the context of a family member. And to the extent that that's what Newman's saying, we reject it. We decline to follow it. So this goes up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in a pretty short opinion, unanimously affirms the conviction, saying, yeah, that Dirks case says when that there is a tipper breaches a fiduciary duty by making a gift of confidential information to a trading relative or friend. And in this case, you had trading relatives, brothers. So you always got to look back at what I like to call patient zero, the insider or the misappropriator giving information to somebody else, and whether or not there's a breach of duty there. And notably, the Supreme Court, which accepted the Salmon case, and a lot of people think that the Supreme Court accepted Salmon and didn't accept to hear Newman because some people have said Salmon's a bit cleaner. It was specifically on personal benefit, not this knowledge of personal benefit stuff. And the Supreme Court said, to the extent that the Second Circuit held that a tipper must also receive something of a pecuniary or similarly valuable nature in exchange for a gift to family or friends, we agree with the Ninth Circuit, and this requirement is inconsistent with our precedent in Dirks, essentially rejecting Newman. Now, this is significant because it overrules Newman's requirement of this quid pro quo that has to exist within the trading relative scenario. But some have argued, okay, that's fine, that's with respect to trading relatives, but when it comes to friends, well, maybe Newman's holding is still valid. Others, obviously the government, have said, no. The Supreme Court was clear, trading relative or friend. And that's what Dirks held. And so therefore, friendship is enough. I don't need to have money coming from one friend to another to patient zero in order for there to be an illegal act. This is up for debate. The Second Circuit recently heard a re-argument in the Martoma case at which this issue has been teed up. And the Martoma case is here in the Second Circuit. So perhaps we'll get some clarity from the Second Circuit on this. Before we wrap up the insider trading portion and get to the FCPA, Andrew's going to talk for 2 minutes about the Stock Act.
2 minutes.
Yeah, well, we don't have the time.
So this is completely off script, so you won't find it in your materials, but I think that this is a really important area, particularly for those of you that are looking at information, gathering information, building investment theses, using information to build out portfolios. And it's front and center with the government right now. This is the world of political intelligence. And I want to set this up in a sort of a different way. So what if an analyst wants to understand or wants information about an agency's thinking on a particular subject or a particular area, say a reimbursement policy? What if an analyst wants to understand how Congress is going to look at tax reform or a particular piece of legislation or something like that, or how Congress might view funding of aircraft carriers? What if an analyst wants to understand how CMS, an agency, or the FDA are viewing particular cancer treatments? Say I'm a doctor, or say want to understand a little bit more on how CMS or an agency or the FDA are going to view reimbursing a particular product, things like that. What if that analyst goes to Congress and trolls around in the halls and knocks on Congress people's doors, asks questions, meets with staffers, meets with aides, ferrets out information about the topic that he or she is interested in? What if that same analyst goes and visits the various agencies, signs in at the front desk, meets with senior officials in the agency, has a closed-door meeting or maybe a small group meeting? Maybe that analyst used to work at that particular agency and has access to the, you know, to the open door policy of different agencies. I mean, I came from the government. We routinely have close-knit meetings at the government. So what if an analyst wants to do all of that? But what if that analyst hires someone else to do it and says, you know what? I don't have time for this. I got to make trades. I want you, consultant, to go, and I want you to hang out in Washington, talk to people, visit agencies, talk to lawyers, talk to other analysts, but find out information about a particular sector or about the way the government is thinking about a certain thing. That's the world of political intelligence, gathering information that's political in nature, pooling it together to come up with an investment thesis or a mosaic. That information is important because it can inform an investment decision about a particular industry or a particular set of companies. And that's where the government is focused right now. Where does legitimate information gathering, legitimate, hard analyst work trip over the insider trading prohibitions? And they're focused like lasers on this, and they've been poking around, and they finally, I think, landed in a place where they're starting to bring cases, and I'm going to use an example in a little bit. But so political intelligence, how does the government define it to start? Political intelligence is defined as information that's derived by a person from direct communications with an executive branch employee or a member of Congress or an employee of Congress and provided in exchange for financial compensation to a person who intends or is known to intend to use the information to make investment decisions. So a consultant goes out, looks, visits the agencies, talks to Congress people, talks to senior officials, comes up with information, and then sells it to Wall Street, sells it to analysts. That's political intelligence. What was the first step that the government did to sort of look at this issue? Well, they enacted what's called the Stock Act, and I'm sure some of you have heard about the Stock Act. It's Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act of 2012. And why that's important is because David and I have been talking about this concept of duty, a duty owed to the source of the information, a duty owed to a company or to its shareholders, not to divulge material non-public information. So what the Stock Act does, it makes clear that members of Congress or executive branch personnel or employees of Congress owe a duty arising from a relationship of trust and confidence to Congress, to the United States government, and the citizens of the United States with respect to material non-public information derived from such persons working at a particular agency or Congress. The issue here is the act was terribly drafted. You heard from Chairman Cox, he was here earlier, he and I had a discussion about this, and it's very flawed. The duty of confidentiality under the Stock Act is extraordinarily broad. It says, you know, a member of Congress or his or her staffer may not reveal material non-public information, but it doesn't define what material non-public information is. So you could have a congressional member or a staffer found liable of insider trading for doing routine duties and just giving out information to a congressperson's constituents. Also raises very interesting questions about free speech. I mean, agencies in Congress are public-facing. Citizens have the right to go and ask questions and get answers, whether it's an agency or Congress. Often, these agencies have a mandate to provide information to the public. And so, and try to kind of sort through this and where the securities laws intersect with political intelligence gathering, you have to really go to the agency themselves to get some guidance as to what could be material non-public information. And then, you know, if you're a downstream user of that information, it gets a little complicated, but I'll just give you a couple examples that I was able to track down. But The House of Representatives has ethics rules, and those rules define material non-public information as information concerning a company, security, industry, or economic sector that is not available to general public and which an investor would consider important in making an investment decision, so pretty broad. The Senate also has ethics rules which define non-public information as confidential or not widely disseminated to the public, and material information as what a reasonable investor would want to know. So you see a little bit of cribbing from the case law, traditional insider trading case law, in the House and Senate ethics rules, and the U.S. Government Ethics Office defines non-public information as information that the employee gains by reason of federal government or federal employment, and that he or she knows or reasonably should know has not been made available to the general public. So again, loose guidance internally to the agency, but not much guidance in the act itself for those external to either Congress or a particular agency. So how is this different from current theories of insider trading? And this is where the discussion gets really interesting. First of all, government employees are not traditional insiders. They're just different. It's really unclear what kind of duty governmental employees actually have vis-a-vis information. There's a natural tension between, say, the Sunshine Act and public disclosure and information that could be viewed as the government, in hindsight, as not supposed to have been shared outwardly. What about, like I laid out at the beginning, consultants, lobbyists, lawyers, doing their job, asking questions, getting answers, making visits? How does that all sort of mesh with traditional insider trading? Materiality is also widely different in the political intelligence space. You know, how a government is thinking about a broad sector, not clear-cut material as the case might be in terms of an earnings release or a ratings change. Very, very different. Which brings me to a good case example, I think, which ties all this together nicely. Then I'll pass it back over to David. So several weeks ago, the SEC and the DOJ concurrently brought a case against a CMS employee, a consultant, a political intelligence consultant, and some portfolio managers. And what the government alleged was, or is alleging, was that the CMS employee had a duty to CMS to keep information confidential. The government further alleged that that employee had passed out information to the consultant about the agency's thinking and decision-making on reimbursement rates for some treatments in the cancer space and in dialysis. The government also alleged that the consultant and the CMS employee were friends, and that the information was being passed along for potential future employment for the employee or for potential pecuniary gain. The government alleged that the consultant knew or consciously, and here's a new one, consciously avoided not knowing that the information the consultant was getting was not to be shared. Well, the consultant in turn passed that information along to his customers, his clients, which were money managers. They too used that information for investment decisions and bought securities in a swath of companies that could potentially be impacted by the CMS rate decisions. The government alleged there too that the portfolio managers knew, should have known, or consciously avoided not knowing that the downstream information they were getting was given in breach of a duty, the CMS employee's duty, to a consultant in exchange for a benefit, and that they knew or should have known or consciously avoid knowing that the information that they had was information that they, as I remember I said at the very beginning, that they should not have to be trading on. And that's the intersection. So the government has taken this industry and squeeze it into an insider trading analysis in an entirely new space. And we'll see how this case turns out. I will tell you that we've been involved in some of these cases before and have successfully extracted companies dealing in political intelligence. So it's going to be interesting to see how this latest case works out. But I think it's going to be a hard fought and a long battle here for the government. David.
So what this is what you care about, right? Avoiding these issues, okay? And what the government is focused on, all right? They want to see the following. And this is not an exhaustive list, but it certainly is an effort based on my experience and looking back at the kind of cases the government's been involved in and what they've said to us, what they're really looking for. They want to see a sufficient number of trained compliance professionals. They want to see clear lines of authority, okay? And they want to see documenting. Documenting if there's issues, if you think there's issues, people, traders or PMs come to you with issues. They want to see you documenting those things and how you resolve them. They want to see compliance manuals that are clear, that define what material non-public information is, and explain what's permitted and what's not. They want a culture of compliance, a leading from the top, that really fosters an adherence to the law. Expert networks, let me say this clear as day, there is nothing illegal about expert networks. The problem became over several years, and especially as notably over 2008 to 2012-13 period, there were a lot of prosecution of expert networks because of the fact that they were being abused. Abused during using the methods that we just discussed earlier. Regular testing and audit of compliance systems, obviously very important. Monitoring the systems and using restricted lists, okay? Monitoring emails, telephone calls, and instant messages periodically, not going crazy, and we know that obviously that can't be done for everybody on a regular basis, on a daily basis. But some of this stuff, whether it's sampling or based on when you need to pre-clear trades and you're looking back at trading activity, at least some of this is being done. Monitoring outside activities, board service, retained consultants, and most notably, education and training. Annualized training, specialized training, and periodic reminders where information is accessible to people on shared networks on the trading items that you and your firm have gone through. Let's talk now in
One quick point.
Yeah.
Just one real quick one, David.
Go ahead.
David made a point about expert networks. I agree. Controlling the information flow, think about it that way, is important. Where's the information coming from? How is the analyst getting the information? How is it being vetted? Are the right questions being asked as part of the controlling the information process is critical. Asking questions, figuring out sort of where the information is coming and the ultimate use of the information, particularly in the expert network space is very important. A good process and procedure there goes a long way.
So one of the other things that was asked to address during this hour is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, particularly given its application recently in this space. And obviously, you know, if you've attended this conference before, you've heard us talking about insider trading, and we spent a lot of time on it today. But we did want to also, as part of this conference, address the FCPA, given its usage recently. And so we're going to give you a bit of an overview of the FCPA so you can get conceptualize it in terms of analyzing issues that you may have in your own workspace. What's really the issues and, you know, what's really on people's mind at the Department of Justice? We're also going to quickly touch third parties. That's where the real risk is, dealing with third parties in FCPA world. And then how to avoid corruption compliance issues. So let's do an overview of the FCPA, Andrew.
So I'll set this up for David real fast, and then I'll turn it over to David to close this out. So statute's been around for a while, enacted in 1977, and it prohibits bribery and corruption of foreign officials and to promote fair business practices, integrity and accountability, and the efficient, equitable distribution of economic resources. So the act created criminal and civil penalties for payments, or even the promise of anything of value by U.S. corporations or U.S. nationals to foreign officials that could be interpreted as bribes for any improper advantage in obtaining or retaining business. So bribes, improper retention of business, obtaining business, or to gain an unfair business advantage. Next slide. So it's broken out. The statute is broken out into two and a half provisions. You have the anti-bribery provisions on one hand. That prohibits bribes of foreign officials for, like I said, for the purpose of obtaining or retaining business. And then there's the accounting side. And you don't need one to get the other, but the accounting provisions requires issuers who have registered securities to make and maintain accurate books and records, number one. And number two, to have an adequate, doesn't need to be perfect, but adequate system of internal accounting controls. Broken out a little further, it's unlawful for an issuer or a domestic concern, so that's anybody really doing business in the United States or anyone acting within the jurisdiction of the United States, so people from a foreign national acting inside the U.S. with corrupt intent, it's important, to directly or indirectly, so indirectly through an agent or someone else, to offer, pay, promise to pay, or authorize payment of anything of value. We'll talk a little bit about what that could be, to a foreign official, we'll talk about who they are, for the purpose of obtaining or retaining or securing any improper advantage. So, who does it apply to? U.S. citizens, like I just mentioned, entities and individuals, wherever located, even if no act was committed in the U.S., to foreign persons, if any act in furtherance of a bribe is done within the U.S., and foreign subs. Intent, like insider trading, there is an intent component here. A person's state of mind is knowing. If a reasonable person knows that such circumstances exist or that such result is substantially certain to occur. So knowledge standard includes actual knowledge of the bribe, or conscious disregard, willful blindness, or deliberate ignorance, which is basically putting your head in the sand. As I mentioned, statute prohibits unlawful payments directly or through a third party. Most of the recent FCPA enforcement cases involve indirect payments, so actions that are based not on the conduct directly engaged in by a company, but rather conduct sort of circuitous through third parties and other vehicles. Examples of third parties through whom illegal payments have been made, you know, agents, consultants, third-party finders or brokers, partners or joint ventures, distributors, lawyers, accountants, and service providers. Does a payment actually have to be made for there to be a violation? No. Okay. An offer or a promise or an authorization to make a prohibited payment is just as illegal as actually making the payment. So a simple offer of a payment is enough to confer liability. Anything of value, really any benefit, money, gifts, discounts, upgrades, entertainment or travel, if excessive, contracts, employment, a series of cases about employment benefits and charitable or political donations can also be viewed as an improper payment.
Where does this all really line up? Okay, so for purposes of what you do, you really have to take those factors that Andrew just described in consideration and think the investments that we're making, the people that we're soliciting investments from. Does it involve foreign officials? Okay, that's really what we're talking about here. Now, note, as we point out here, these bullets, foreign officials has been interpreted very broadly and certainly can stretch as far as family members of government, of individuals in government, political candidates, officers and employees of government instrumentalities, so think state-owned companies. So this is really quite broad, and that's why the FCPA, especially with obviously the interconnectedness that exists in the global economy, has really been in play quite a bit in the last decade, and we believe will probably continue to be an area of enforcement going forward for quite some time. And again, remember that government instrumentalities can be state-owned and state-controlled entities. This comes up quite a bit, particularly whether it be in Asia or East Asia, where a number of companies can be state-controlled entities that somebody is investing in, or that become a subsidiary, or that you're soliciting investments from, or sovereign wealth funds that are investing in your fund. All of these come into play when you're dealing with foreign officials. So what is really an unfair business advantage? What's the focus here? Many cases involve clear cases of securing a government contract, but gaining a competitive advantage is enough. Things like influence over legislation or technical specifications to influence some kind of bid that you're going to get. So that's why this is so broad. That's why we wanted to discuss it with you here today, even at this tail end of the hour here. Defenses to the FCPA. There are a number of them, okay? And they have been used quite a bit recently with a lot of FCPA enforcement activity. And these are the three areas which I'll briefly walk through. Bona fide promotional expenditures, written local law that actually permits some level of conduct, be it bribery or otherwise, and three, facilitating payments, which are basically intended to expedite routine non-discretionary actions. So when it comes to promotional expenditures, things like entertainment and travel and gifts, so long as they're nominal, all right, if you're inviting foreign officials to come, they gotta be nominal, can't be something substantial. Facilitating payments, things to get the job done, to get those licenses, to get the permits that you need. Sometimes, you know, you need to pay an extra fee to get it done quicker. Now, Under the FCPA, it may be a defense. Under the UK Bribery Act and other anti-bribery legislation, not so much. The accounting provisions of the FCPA come into play here also. And this basically has to do with the idea that folks, entities who are paying bribes, well, they're not really recording it on their books and records as bribe payments, okay? And if you're an issuer and you gotta make regular filings, well, your books and records have to be accurate. And if you're not recording them as bribes or some kind of solicitation payments, well, then it's not accurate. If you're recording them as something else, you're lying about it, then that obviously violates the accounting provisions, the books and records provisions. And some quick examples of this include things like, I just described, mischaracterizing the bribes, false travel and entertainment expenses, custom intervention payments that people, we've seen those put down, and that's again to try to facilitate something, which could be a defense, but bottom line is it doesn't look so good. So, of course, there's lots of fines and penalties, which include things like prison, reputational damages, and various other kinds of penalties. Where are we concerned here? We're concerned about third parties, okay? That's really where the FCPA enforcement activity is. And those are things, people like sales agents or channel partners or distributors in foreign countries who are trying to help get the job done. Except they're helping to get the job done through greasing government officials. So even though it's being done through third parties, there are risks here because the FCPA expressly prohibits corrupt payments that are made through third parties or intermediaries. It is not sufficient to say, oh, it's out of my hands, I gave it to somebody else. That's what we call willful blindness, when you're turning a blind eye and you have a reason to know that something bad's about to happen. And so you gotta look for the red flags when dealing with third parties. And this is a lot of red flags on the side, and it's in your book. But things like third-party consulting agreements that only sort of vaguely describe the services that are being performed, a third party that's related closely with a foreign official, a shell company that's the third party, payment to offshore bank accounts that doesn't seem to match up with what the third party is doing, a lack of transparency in the third party's record keeping. Those are sort of examples here. And obviously, when you're dealing with particular countries that have a history of corruption risk, that should only redder, if you will, make it more red, the flags that you're looking at. What are the government's expectations here? Okay, to wrap this up. Understand what they're doing, these third parties are doing. Know your exposure. Include anti-bribery clauses in these third-party contracts. And don't just accept representations. Conduct an analysis. Because you want to, obviously, avoid all of these issues, okay? And how do you avoid the government coming and knocking when it comes to the FCPA world? Know who your business partners are. Know your exposure liability. Understand the services that are being provided and how they're being provided. Implement an effective compliance program. Escalate any issues to internal and external counsel because, look, no one size fits all here. Everything is tailored based on the business risks. So you want to have a clearly articulated corporate policy that zeroes in on the corruption risk that's involved when dealing with these particular countries and uses due diligence and oversights of agents, these third parties. Document your compliance efforts and periodically review them. That's essentially what we wanted to go in the highlights that we wanted to present to you in the world of the FCPA. It has relevance in the hedge fund world now, and we've seen it recently in investigations and enforcement activity by DOJ and SEC. So bottom line is, if you're dealing in investments overseas, you're dealing with corruption, areas that are rife with corruption, and you really have to drill down. You have to drill down in who you're dealing with, who are your distributors and agents, who are the people from the sovereign wealth funds that are investing in your fund, what is happening, what is the source of funds, and where you're sending these funds and the investments to. It's not enough to say it's out of my hands, it's out of this country. The FCPA mandates that you do more. So we wanted to highlight that for you. Hopefully, this has been informative between highlighting the insider trading risks as well as the FCPA risks that are relevant now in dealing with these continuing robust areas of enforcement by the DOJ and the SEC. Thanks for your time.
to listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.